Well, this is Webster Tarpley here in Edinburgh, and I've been studying the Venetians really since about the 1950s, and I actually wrote my senior essay in Princeton about the Italian background of Milton, which leads you right into this Sarpi network. So I've been studying this for quite a few years and given lectures about it. So the basic idea is the following. The characteristic methods of the Roman Empire and the Byzantine Empire did not end when the Roman Empire in the West became extinct in 476 or so AD, nor did they end in the 1450s when Constantinople was captured by the Turks, by the Ottoman Empire. But rather, there had been a transfer of a significant part of the Byzantine culture and method in terms of imperialist method, geopolitics, and especially the principle they have that religion serves the state. As you remember, in Byzantium, of course, they have this Caesaropapism, and the emperor is a god, and the religion is a department of the government, because the patriarch is always appointed. He's very much under the thumb of the emperor. Now, here in Western Europe, it's always been very different, because here we have the emperor and the pope, or the king and the pope, are different people, and they fight. And this is what has opened up in the Western mind the notion of separation of powers and a kind of an anti-totalitarian bias, because you're not dealing with one power center, you're dealing with two. And that makes all the difference in the world in terms of being able to think for yourself, because you're called upon to choose. And it is no coincidence, of course, that the origins of modern Europe are in these Italian city-states of northern Italy, precisely in the area where the influence of both the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor, where this crosses, and therefore you have a choice, right? You can be a Guelph and go with the Pope, you can be a Ghibelline and go with the Emperor. Now, the Venetians are a branch, they claim, of the Byzantine Empire. And they claim that they go back to the time when Attila the Hun was on his way to Rome, that the refugees fled into the lagoon. So they would tell you that the foundation of Venice is in the 400 AD range, and that's probably too soon. But they do go back a long way, right? And, of course, in oligarchy, the antiquity of your family means a great deal. And by that standard, the Royal House of England are complete upstarts compared to any respectable Venetian family who go back 700, 900, 1,000 years. And, of course, the normal nobility of England and France don't come anywhere close to that. So it is a conduit for the mentality of the Byzantine Empire to come into the modern world. Now, of course, it is the main medieval banking center. The banking centers of the Middle Ages are basically two. One is Venice, one is Genoa. And they are rivals, but there's much that they have in common, although the Genoese never quite get that Byzantine method. And, of course, what it means is that in Genoa, the place is torn up by faction fights. But what the Venetians have been able to do is to create institutions that allow them to have an oligarchy, but at the same time to have what amounts to a totalitarian, in some ways communistic, order under the control of an extremely narrow patrician class of maybe 2,000 people in a society that varies from maybe 500,000 to 4 or 5 million at different times. If we look at their influence, right, by having money lending networks and trade networks, although very seldom manufacturing, that's the big thing with the Venetians. The Florentines under the Medici produce textiles. The Venetians produce very little bit of glass, little bit of lace, but mainly it's banking, insurance, financial services, and simply trade, which means taking other people's production and turning that into money on a different market. If we look at, let's say, the Plantagenet dynasty here, the Plantagenets in England are very largely puppets of Venice. The best example is Edward III, and Edward III starts this lunatic adventure of the Hundred Years' War, which really is the the destruction of medieval civilization is very largely mediated with the Hundred Years' War between 1350 and about 1450, because these are the two most advanced parts of Western Europe. And it is the Venetians who invite and encourage Edward III to do that, because the Venetians are always afraid that the French are going to come and crush them. And the Hundred Years' War coincides pretty much with the final struggle between Venice and Genoa. And the French, of course, might have taken that opportunity to conquer both of them. So they make sure that France is completely tied up with this Hundred Years' struggle with the English. William of Ockham, that some people value, I don't, one of the stupidest nominalists of the late Middle Ages, is in his political form, is also completely to be condemned, because he's actually working in Bavaria, King Ludwig of Bavaria. He's trying to essentially, what Ockham is doing is to try to get Ludwig of Bavaria to open a second front against the French, to weaken them even more vis-a-vis the English, and again, to make sure the main issue is that the French are not going to give any trouble to the Venetians. Generally speaking, over the years, you'll find that the Venetians have hostile relations to their immediate neighbors, and then beyond that, you might find a belt of states where they have better relations, and the example, of course, is England. The Venetians, I just delved into this a little bit, and I hope to be able to write this up for the 500th anniversary of Luther now in 2017, if I lived that long. The Venetian method extends into doing things like this. You have the War of the League of Cambrai in 1509, almost completely forgotten. It is a world war. It is the great world war at the beginning of the modern era. And at the beginning of it, it's a very one-sided combination. It is essentially France, Spain, the Holy Roman Emperor, the Pope, most of the smaller Italian states, and a few others, all against the Venetians. So it's Europe against Venice. And there's a very interesting painting, the Allegory of the League of Cambrai, which by Palma Giovane, which is displayed in the room of the Venetian Senate. If you're going to go from the Venetian Senate to the room of the Doge and his advisors, you've got to go under this painting of a woman on a bull attacking Venice, meaning Venice is anti-European in the deepest sense. They're Byzantine, and they also seek the ruin of all the European powers, and they do succeed in getting out of that fix. But one of the ways they do it is the Venetians are very, very much afraid now, not only of the French, who defeat them in a big battle, which is a catastrophe for them, the Battle of Agnadello in 1509, but the Venetians are also concerned about a huge army coming down from Germany, and at one point, an army of about 100,000 people, if you count the camp followers, one of the biggest armies ever seen in Europe, comes down and besieges the Venetians pretty much in their lagoons. So they respond to that in a characteristic way, which is to try to create a diversion in Germany so that people will be fighting and killing each other in Germany, far away from Venice, north of the Alps, and they won't be troubled by any more invasions. And what they therefore do is mobilize their networks, and they find that the humanist of central Germany, Mucianus Rufus, has a pupil. Mucianus is somebody who's been in contact with Venetian oligarchs, as he writes in his letters. And Mucianus says he's got a protege by the name of Spalatin, another German humanist, who is actually the at this time, he's rising through the bureaucracy of King Frederick, Elector Frederick the Wise of Saxony, the ruler of Saxony, up in northern Germany, the area around, Leipzig and Wittenberg and places like this. And out of this combination of Mucianus and Spalatin, they find Luther. Luther fits their needs to a T, because he's an extremely crude German nationalist, which is a great cover. He's, how can I say it? In terms of theology, he's about as primitive as possibly can be. And he also, interestingly enough, claims that salvation is by faith alone and not by any works. In other words, you're not supposed to, the works of charity are devalued in this. And it just happens to turn out that one of the greatest experts of the Venetian intelligence service, one of the greatest game masters of the last 1,000 years, is a fellow called Gasparo Contarini, who was actually a cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church at this point. Or he will be, sorry, at this point he's not, but he will be. And Contarini, in the middle of this crisis of the Venetian state, has had a religious crisis of his own, where he comes about one micron away from endorsing the notion of faith alone, salvation by faith alone, that we humans are poor worms and we're not really capable of love, and therefore the only thing we can do is hope that God will help us. And he does this in a way that indicates that it's a doctrinal break. So in about, 1513, we have Contarini having this experience. And then a few years later, we have Luther having exactly the same kind of experience, just one step further. He says it's faith alone, no works at all, only grace, only faith, and only by the scriptures. And that basically, that comes out of the War of the League of Cambrai. In other words, most people don't realize that the Luther Reformation comes in a time of war, and indeed of a general European war, which has got Henry VIII in it. In other words, this is when Henry VIII invades northern France, and the French at a certain point are in really bad shape. It's the time of Wolsey and Henry VIII, and they go with Venice most of the time, not completely, but most of the time. So I think that's an interesting example of the Venetian method. The other one that I think is extremely important is Paolo Sarpi. But it even goes back further. For example, let's take Henry VIII. When Henry VIII has his great fight with the Pope, there's this question about, can he marry Anne Boleyn? Can he divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn? So what Henry VIII does is he writes letters to all the universities of Europe, and he asks them, you know, am I right to do this? Is this, you know, can I put away Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn? And he gets back a lot of responses, but the most positive one he gets is from the Venetians in Padua. And there's this character, he's a really kooky, rationalist writer by the name of Francesco Giorgi, or Dorzi, who's a Venetian oligarch. He's a friend of Contarini, that we've just mentioned, the guy who basically dishes up Luther for you. And Dorzi comes to the English court, and he delivers the opinion. Henry is delighted with him. And Dorzi then stays at the English court pretty much for the rest of his life as what amounts to Henry VIII's resident sex advisor. So there's an intrigue, and most of the books that you read about Henry VIII don't have this fact. Anyway, Sarpi comes, 75 years later, and Sarpi is concerned with the fact that the Venetians are getting weaker and weaker, and he's got to promote another general war, which is going to become the 30 Years' War. So this is the era of the Gunpowder Plot of 1605, the Spanish conspiracy against Venice alleged in 1618, and then the defenestration of Prague, right? The beginning of the 30 Years' War, also in May of 1618. And what you see here is that Sarpi is the ego ideal of many people in England. In other words, there's an English cult of Sarpi, which would include such people as John Donne, Sir Francis Bacon, Thomas Hobbes, John Milton, other people maybe less known, Sir Dudley Carleton, Foreign Secretary, Sir Henry Wotton almost became Foreign Secretary, the guy who brought the Palladio architecture to England and otherwise was the Provost of Eton, various other churchmen, the Herbert family, Herbert of Cherbury. Also, these are also ancestors of Bush, by the way, the Herbert. There's a whole book about Sarpi's Englishmen, right? Paolo Sarpi and his English friends. Sarpi, of course, is the most famous person in Europe who's not a king or a prince, and he's involved in the interdict, the so-called struggle between Venice and the papacy in 1606 and 1607, which he wins. He attracts the imagination of all of Protestant Europe by being a Catholic friar who opposes the Pope on a matter of jurisdiction? Does the Vatican have the right to say certain churchmen who are criminals have to be delivered to the church, or can they be punished in the normal courts? And the Pope, of course, says that it all belongs to me. So later on, you have people like Gibbon, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, is a great admirer of Sarpi. Trevor Roper loves Sarpi, the professor of history at Oxford, Lord Dacre, until quite recently. And, well, we can just go through the list. In other words, Dr. Johnson, they all love this Sarpi.
But what's the Sarpi method?
Well, the Sarpi method, of course, is to create religious warfare. In other words, you have to do a divide and conquer, right? The Venetians believe that religion serves state interest. And therefore, what you have a network around Sarpi, and Sarpi's friends, not just these English ones, but they help. And the other ones that he has a group in Holland, a group in Poland, a group in France, a group in, you name it, he's got it. He's got a group in North America, which is a little bit weaker. But what they do is they're essentially involved in making peaceful coexistence. I'll give you one example. In Holland, there are two parties. In the Netherlands, there's the Oldenbarneveld party, and this is the great hero of the Dutch. He created the country, like George Washington. And then there's this other guy who's Prince Maurice of Nassau. So Oldenbarneveld says tolerance towards Protestant minorities inside, peace with Spain, and peaceful economic development based on, you know, manufacturing. And the Maurice of Nassau says no tolerance, extreme Calvinism, war with Spain, and loot the Spanish and Portuguese empires with the Dutch fleet. So Sarpi is supposed to be, most academics will tell you Sarpi is a great friend of tolerance and moderation. Of course, he comes in on the side of the extremist Maurice of Nassau. And Dudley Carleton, Sarpi's right-hand man at this point, the Englishman, he intervenes to make sure that Oldenbarneveld has his head chopped off. It's amazing. It's George Washington, and his own country kills him. So this is what the Venetians do, and you can see how they're doing this in all these other countries. One of the things going on is the assassination of Henry IV of France, King Henry IV, Le Bon Henri. And everybody has always said the Catholics did this, but it's not at all certain that the Catholics did it, and it may indeed have been a false flag. In other words, it's a Catholic friar who does it, but who sent him there? So the point of this is, what we get to, is that the Whig party in England is the Venetian party. The great aristocrats, right, the court party, the top nobility, people who vie with the king, these are the Venetian party. And I've tried to call attention to this novel by Benjamin Disraeli called Coningsby, 1844, where you get this. He actually comes out and says it in very blunt terms, and I welcome that because that is a confirmation of research that I had done over decades before I ever heard of Coningsby or ever knew about Disraeli as a novelist in this kind of a context. There's a guy called Sir Edwin Sandys, known as the first Whig, and he is a Sarpi collaborates in writing this guy's book and in getting it published. And basically, Sandys and Sarpi are co-authors of a book, and that's the guy who's the first Whig. So if you want to know how did London become this imperial center and banking center, and how did the Foreign Office ever get their method of divide and conquer, you have to look at the Venetians. Walsingham founded the Secret Intelligence Service. He was trained in Venice. He was a Bloody Mary exile.
Now MI6?
Well, secret in SIS, secret in MI6. So Walsingham had to go to Padua during the time of Bloody Mary, and in that time it's clear he's recruited, he's trained, and he brings back the Venetian method of creating religious conflict. And this is what you see then. This is the background of the gunpowder plot, is that, because that's how Cecil gets it. Cecil, you know, Lord Burghley, Cecil the Elder, Robert Cecil the Younger, and these are contemporaries and enemies of Shakespeare. So Shakespeare is somebody who's anti-Venetian. He's actually pro-Catholic. And it basically, the whole idea of who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, according to these Whig historians, is bunk.
And Shakespeare uses a lot of these figures in as sort of archetypes in his play.
Well, I mean, he's commenting on all this stuff. In other words, he's trying to warn King James, don't fall into the trap. When Elizabeth is alive, he's trying very hard to educate her. And it's basically, he's always pushing. Shakespeare really does want religious tolerance. And he wants that to be extended to the very large Catholic minority, which may even be a majority, we don't know, in England at this time. And again, that's a fact that the Whig historians have completely blotted out. So as Disraeli writes in Coningsby, if you don't know these things, it's because you've had your history written by the Venetian party, and it has been in their interest to suppress all awareness of this huge Venetian presence in Britain. And this, it includes the money, because you say, well, how does the Bank of England emerge in the late 1600s? And part of it is the huge family fortunes are transferred from Venice first to Amsterdam primarily, and then on to London, and also here. Edinburgh has its own Venetian story, which is maybe not so dramatic, but it's substantial.
So which are the most important figures in Shakespeare, you think, come from this idea?
Coming from what? The Cecils, right? The Cecils generally, as a family, are in the Venetian orbit. So therefore, when you see Shakespeare, Polonius in Hamlet is Cecil the Elder, Burghley, William Cecil. Robert Cecil, he hates even more, because that's more in his face when he's in the height of his career. So this is now Richard III is Robert Cecil. Caliban is the misshapen creature of the tempest, monster. That's Robert Cecil, who is a hunchback, so Shakespeare goes after him on that. Lord Angelo in Measure for Measure, if you know, the hypocrite who spouts moralizing sermons while attempting to abuse women and do all this stuff. This is also part of the attack on the Cecil. So you can go on. I recommend here this book called Shadow Play by Claire Asquith, which is a very perceptive reading of the Shakespearean canon based on the important understanding that Shakespeare is this Catholic subversive, Catholic underground activist. And the other book on this is Hildegard Hammerschmidt Hummel, H-U-M-M-E-L. I think it's called The True Face of Shakespeare. It just came out in English. And this, what she shows is that the Shakespeare got his little Latin and less Greek in a Jesuit college in the Low Countries, and that during the lost years, he was, of course, in Rome at least once a year to visit the Jesuit English college in Rome, the Collegio Inglese. And this, of course, has to do with what people have noticed, if you're at all perceptive, that he knows everything about Verona. In other words, look at these Shakespeare plays, right? Where are half of them set? It's either Venice or Verona or Milan, right? Measure for Measure is about the Duke of Milan and all the rest of it. And indeed, The Tempest is, you know, it's got to be who's going to be the Duke of Milan, or is he a usurper? So think of all this and realize that that's the conflict that's being fought out. Now, look, from our point of view, we'd have to say we are in the tradition of Shakespeare. If Shakespeare is trying to prevent false flag operations, if you look at Macbeth, Shakespeare is saying, look, fellow Catholics, I'm a Catholic, so are you. Don't be a patsy. Don't fall for Cecil. If Cecil sends you some provocateur double agent who says, let's go out and have a terror plot, don't be so stupid as to fall into this nonsense. That's pretty much Macbeth. And then you see these other plays. Othello is an attempt to warn James, watch out for that Iago that you have running the show, that's Cecil, Robert. And then the other one is King Lear, right? In other words, if you're King Lear, don't give your kingdom away to somebody else, Goneril and Regan. But it really means Cecil, because the idea was that King James, in his pedantry and his ineptitude, he really turns the government over to Cecil. And Shakespeare is saying, you can't do that. Not with Cecil, anyway. So the Cecil, you know, Carol Quigley that you mentioned before, Carol Quigley, writing in the 1930s about Lady Astor and the Cliveden set, he writes about the Cecil Bloc, and what he means by that is the Conservative Party. Right? There's a Lord Salisbury who's Prime Minister in the late 19th century, right, during the height of imperialism. So the Cecils are still around. I don't know if they were around you know, as individual names, I think they are, but I don't know exactly who they are.
So how did the Clive and Set operate? I mean, what were sort of methods to run the empire and expand the empire?
We just go back a little bit. If you want to, the predicament of the 20th century is basically this, right? That the British Empire in the second half of the 19th century has already begun to decline because there's a failure in mass education here. Right? You're not giving people enough, you haven't opened up your universities for a scientific and technological education for a whole lot more people. Because the Oxford-Cambridge aristocratic snob mentality has dominated. And therefore, people, they don't want to do science and technology. There's a much greater prestige attached to dilettanting in literature and history and things like this within this Whig model. So you see the Germans beginning to get ahead, the French beginning to get ahead, even the U.S. begins to get ahead. And so you have this empire which is slowly declining, right? You get in the 1890s, you have a big pound crisis around Barings Bank and the Venezuelan debt crisis. So by the time you get to about the late 1890s, you have a situation which is not good. And then you have the Boer War. Now, here's this. Remember we had the League of Cambrai before, 1509? Everybody gangs up on Venice. Well, when the British... In the 1899, right, the Boers of South Africa revolt, and the British have some huge defeats in the first couple of months. And what they see at that point is that they're universally hated. Because what happens at that time is that Count Witte in Russia puts out a bid to Germany and France saying, look, you know, look what they're doing, these British, right? Why don't we have the continental bloc? Let's have an alliance of France, Germany, Russia. And let's stop spending all our money on armaments and let's have a peace race and we'll pull ahead of the British because we won't have this crazy arms race, right? We won't need to be at each other's throats all the time. And there was interest in the circles of a guy called Gabriel Hanotaux, and some others in the French foreign policy establishment. But the person who saved the British Empire at that point is Kaiser Wilhelm, Emperor William of Germany. He's an absolute idiot and an Anglophile. You know, the first thing he wanted when World War I was over, he said, I can finally have another cup of English tea. And he, of course, had this, he had a hate-love relationship with his English mother. So he had a very complex psychology. So that was, you can say that the Boer War is a League of Cambrai moment when it almost came about. If this stupid German emperor hadn't said no, there could have been the continental bloc. And at that point, you know, the Foreign Office divide and conquer stuff would just not have worked anymore. And of course, the king, the Prince of Wales, up until the early 1900s, and he's going to be king for all, but he's been Prince of Wales for about half a century, is Edward VII. So what Edward VII does is he goes into high gear. He's a tremendously important figure. He is the most energetic and successful operative of the House of Hanover, Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, Guelph, by far. And what he does is he creates the Triple Entente. He creates the Nutcracker Alliance of Russia and France to crush Germany and Austria-Hungary, and the British fleet, of course, blockades all of them. And that's your recipe for World War I. So if you want to say one person who contributed the most to preparing World War I and allowing it to get going, it's him. Of course, he dies in 1911, but you would have to also add that a lot of the people who actually carry out the war, Admiral Sir Jackie Fisher of the Admiralty, Sir Edward Grey of the Foreign Office, Winston Churchill, they're all personal protégés of Edward VII. So his networks are the ones that take you into this war. Now, the war is, of course, a catastrophe. And it's interesting that in this case, even the aristocracy is massacred on the battlefield because it just gets to be out of all conceivable proportion. It's World War I is a catastrophe from which we really have never recovered. Nobody has, because it leads... World War I is bad enough. Out of that, you get fascism, communism, depression, and World War II and a Cold War, and now we've just woken up from that into the hangover of globalism and economic liberalization. But now the Astor set. By about, you know, the 1930s, the big fear is Stalin, because Stalin has decided to industrialize the Soviet Union, and he's succeeding, and this is becoming a huge power. So there are people who look around, and of course you always have a choice, right? The government in London could have said, well, you know, we're going to get out of the Depression, and we're going to go to comprehensive economic development. We're going to have a solid alliance system where we stick with the French and some others, and we will be able to get through it. And indeed, we try to promote economic recovery in Germany, but they didn't do that. They have the reparations going on, right? The world economy is crushed by the Versailles reparations. So what they say is, look, we can't do anything about Stalin, but what we can do is let's create a kamikaze regime in Germany and play them against Russia and get rid of both of them. And what we want to do is put in somebody who's only going to go east. So, of course, there's this demagogue Hitler running around. He's actually a creature of German military intelligence, a Field Marshal Ludendorff, and people like this. So let's put him in. And he's a racist, and he's got this anti-Slav ideology. The problem is he also had an anti-British, anti-French ideology because of the Versailles business. So he's somebody who's going to go in both directions. So what the Clifton set amounts to, and that's Lord Astor, Lord John Jacob Astor, and the other one, two of them, Lady Astor, is an aristocratic Confederate from Virginia, Lord Brand, Lord Lothian, Lord Halifax, anyway, a bunch of lords. They represent the pro-Hitler group in the British ruling class. There's also the Duke of Hamilton. There's Lord Montague Norman, the governor of the Bank of England. And then, of course, you have people like Prescott Bush, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles in the United States. They're all pro-Nazi. And they're all essentially involved in this idea of divide and conquer in Europe. So we're going to build up Hitler. We're going to make sure we get Hitler. In other words, they don't want to have a military government. They don't want to have a democratic government. They want Hitler because they feel that he is a madman, but he's motivated by this racial theory and that he's going to go east. So they consider him a one-way gun. You can read, all kinds of stuff about the Clifton set. I've written some essays about it myself. Carol Quigley is quite good on many aspects of the Clifton set. So Sir Neville Chamberlain, so-called appeaser, is a creature of this group. That's his social milieu. In other words, where does he go on the weekend? He goes to Cliveden to hobnob with Lady Astor, Lord Astor, and the rest of these people. The specific way they did it was that Lady Astor's hobby was welfare, sort of literacy and health care for poor families, stuff like this. So in one of the Stanley Baldwin governments, Chamberlain, and he's the son of Joseph Chamberlain, who was the mayor of Birmingham, I think, and a great imperialist around the turn of the century. Joseph Chamberlain was a big imperialist ideologue. Neville Chamberlain gets to be the health minister, and Lady Astor cultivates him. Then that's her specialty, and she eventually gets elected into the parliament, too. So in that way, Chamberlain is drawn into this group, and that way he becomes not an appeaser, because that's not the idea. He becomes pro-Hitler in the sense that he wants to build up Hitler. And a deal might have been possible. In other words, a deal where, for example, Germany took the lead in attacking the Soviets and the British were kind of a benevolent, neutral, on the side of Hitler. The problem with it was that Hitler said, look, you have a democratic government, and Chamberlain, if you lose the election, how can you guarantee me that the next guy won't be against me? And an interesting thing at this point, the British people generally don't like Hitler, and that's very good. And that's what Hitler points to. He says, look, your population hates me. What if you fall and some other government comes in? How can I be sure that I can trust you? And if you know the orchestration of the Munich conference, it's a stunt I would call it a false flag, but that's it's something along those lines. Because essentially what they do with the Munich conference is there's already an understanding between Hitler and Chamberlain that Czechoslovakia is going to be carved. It's going to disappear. But what they do is they have to create the illusion of imminent world war so that then everybody will accept the fact that Czechoslovakia is going to be compromised. In other words, you get people hysterical. What Chamberlain does is he says, start digging bomb trenches in the parks and start giving everybody a gas mask. So somebody comes to your house and gives you a gas mask, you get terrified. So they stampede the people into not opposing this Czechoslovakian sellout. And that way, Chamberlain gets a couple of more years to go along with this policy. And that's what starts World War II. So what turns out is that when you play this geopolitics, eventually you antagonize everybody, and maybe they gang up on you, or you blunder into war some other way. So what the result of that is that geopolitics does not work. And tell that now to the people in Washington, because they are now, these are now the amateur bunglers who are trying to practice geopolitics. They say, ha, 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 we'll box in Iran, right? We'll have Pakistan in crisis and attacking them. We'll have Afghanistan going on. We'll have the Kurds going on. We'll have Iraq going on. We'll have a million and one secret armies coming in of terrorists and PKK and PJAK and all the rest of it. The problem with that is, if you don't have a positive conception of a peace order, you're going to have war. And eventually the war is going to come and get you. And the basis, of course, in the modern world, the basis of a peace order is always an approach to international economic development. And, of course, this is what the Astors didn't want. So that's an idea of them as people who... Literally, they choose to support Hitler, and then it backfires, blows up right in their face, and that accounts for the desperate situation of Britain in the fall of 1940 and during 1941, because they could have supported the French, but they didn't at various key points. In other words, they basically dumped the French and didn't treat them as a real ally.